2 years passed. The departures of Wilson and Spencer left Smith and Hickok and Andrews alone with the row's burning lights and veiled windows. The privileges granted ordinary prisoners were denied them. No radios or card games, not even an exercise period. Indeed, they were never allowed out of their cells, except each Saturday when they were taken to a shower room, then given a once-weekly change of clothing. The only other occasions for momentary release were the far-between visits of lawyers or relatives. Mrs. Hickok came once a month. Her husband had died, she had lost the farm, and, as she told Dick, lived now with one relative, now another. It seemed to Perry as though he existed deep underwater. Perhaps because the row usually was as gray and quiet as ocean depths, soundless except for snores, coughs, the whisper of slippered feet, the feathery racket of the pigeons nesting in the prison walls. But not always. Sometimes, Dick wrote in a letter to his mother, you can't hear yourself think. They throw men in the cells downstairs, what they call the hole, and plenty of them are fighting mad and crazy to boot. Curse and scream the whole time. It's intolerable, so everybody starts yelling, shut up. I wish you'd send me earplugs. Only they wouldn't allow me to have them. No rest for the wicked, I guess. The little building had been standing for more than a century, and seasonal changes provoked different symptoms of its antiquity. Winter cold saturated the stone and iron fixtures, and in summer, when temperatures often hurtled over the 100 mark, the old cells were malodorous cauldrons. So hot my skin stings, Dick wrote in a letter dated July 5, 1961. I try not to move much. I just sit on the floor. My bed's too sweaty to lie down, and the smell makes me sick because of only the one bath a week and always wearing the same clothes. No ventilation whatever, and the light bulbs make everything hotter. Bugs keep bumping on the walls. Unlike conventional prisoners, the condemned are not subjected to a work routine. They can do with their time what they like. Sleep all day, as Perry frequently did. I pretend I'm a tiny little baby that can't keep its eyes open. Or, as was Andrew's habit, read all night. Andrew's averaged 15 to 20 books a week. His taste encompassed both trash and belles lettres, and he liked poetry, Robert Frost's particularly. But he also admired Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and the comic poems of Ogden Nash. Though the quenchless quality of his literary thirst had soon depleted the shelves of the prison library, the prison chaplain and others sympathetic to Andrews kept him supplied with parcels from the Kansas City Public Library. Dick was rather a bookworm, too. But his interest was restricted to two themes. Sex, as represented in the novels of Harold Robbins and Irving Wallace. Perry, after being lent one of these by Dick, returned it with an indignant note. Degenerate filth for filthy degenerate minds. And law literature. He consumed hours each day leafing through law books, compiling research that he hoped would help reverse his conviction. Also, in pursuit of the same cause, he fired off a cannonade of letters to such organizations as the American Civil Liberties Union and the Kansas State Bar Association, letters attacking his trial as a travesty of due process and urging the recipients to aid him in his quest for a new trial. Perry was persuaded to draft similar pleas, but when Dick suggested that Andy follow their example by writing protests in his own behalf, Andrews replied, "I'll worry about my neck, and you worry about yours." Actually, Dick's neck was not the part of his anatomy that most immediately troubled him. "My hair is coming out by the handfuls," he confided in yet another letter to his mother. "I'm frantic. Nobody in our family was bald-headed as I can recall, and it makes me frantic the idea of being an ugly old bald head.